Welcome, I'm Craig Sutledge, and today we're going to be having a discussion under the theme Hospitality as a Way of Life and Worship. One of the resources that I've used in preparing for today is a book that's in the bookstore, which you might, if you're not familiar with it, take a look at it. It's called Reaching Out by Henry Nouwen. Henry Nouwen, of course, has written many books. He is a Roman Catholic, does a great deal of writing in the area of spirituality. It's a good book, and if you haven't looked at it, I think you'd find it to be an interesting one. The direction that we want to look at in terms of our life, it's going to be both our personal lives, our lives and our families, as well as life in the church. And that's the movement from hostis to hospice. The Latin from hostility to hospitality. And I think it's probably doesn't take a lot of remembering or recounting for us to be aware of the fact that the stance we have as human beings in the world is frequently hostility. It's suspicion, it's distrust or mistrust, it's all the things that keep us from each other. The walls, the barriers, and so forth. And this movement from hostis, from hostility to hospitality, is one in which we create a space or a place where strangers can feel welcome in our presence. And that's what I want to look at. And I'm talking now, I'll say more about who these strangers are and what it means. But the definition that Henry Nouwen uses, which I find to be a very interesting one, is hospitality is the creation of a free and friendly space where we can reach out to strangers and invite them to become our friends. The biblical text, I'm going to move this timer because otherwise that tape is going to sound like it's a time bomb going off. You remember the story of Abraham and Sarah, of course. And remember the visitation of the three men. So the men turned from there and went towards Sodom. Let's see, I'm wrong verse here. Oh, yes. And the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men stood in front of him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, "My Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree, while I fetch a morsel of bread, that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on, since you have come to your servant." So they said, "Do as you have said." And Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes." And Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the servant who hastened to prepare it. Then he took curds and milk and the calf which he had prepared and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. They said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, "She is in the tent." The Lord said, "I will surely return to you in the spring, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. I love that colloquialism in the RSV. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I have grown old and my husband is old, shall I have pleasure?" The Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? At the appointed time I will return to you in the spring, and Sarah shall have a son.'" Well, what happened there? We have three visitors, three strangers, and Abraham welcomes them. He is a gracious, hospitable host, and he gives them food to drink. And what happens? What transpires? These three strangers become the Lord God, and God gives this promise to Abraham and Sarah that they shall have a child. The lesson we heard last night. Which Sunday are we in? Second, third Sunday of Trinity, or after Pentecost? The widow of Zareth offers Elijah food and drink, even though she has almost nothing. And what happens? Elijah takes this gift and transforms it, and she has food and drink in abundance. And as we heard last night, her son is even restored to life after death. So in these stories, in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, we have this wonderful picture not only of hospitality, of the example of God's people welcoming strangers into their midst, but what do we have? We have the strangers, the ones who are welcomed, bringing the gifts that they bring. And I think that's a paradigm, an example of what can happen in terms of our relationship to the world, to humankind, that instead of looking at the world through this picture of hostility, of suspicion and distrust, we practice hospitality, and in so doing, we discover that those who come to us as strangers become friends bearing gifts. When hostility is converted into hospitality, Henry Nouwen writes, then fearful strangers can become guests, revealing to their hosts the promise they are carrying with them. So let's look more carefully at the word hospitality and then use some examples in terms of your lives and my life. I looked this up. The German word is Gastfreundschaft. I think that's close. Gastfreundschaft, which means friendship for the guest. That's the German word for hospitality. And therefore, hospitality means primarily a place where someone comes as a stranger and leaves as a friend or becomes a friend. It's to invite others into a new relationship. Again, the difference, a relationship not of suspicion or distrust, but rather a relationship of openness, of acceptance, where the stranger is free to be whom he or she is. And that doesn't mean imposing ourselves upon the other. It doesn't mean forcing that person into what we are or what we do, but rather allowing that person the space and the freedom and the acceptance to be who they are. Nouwen uses a wonderful illustration that just as we can't force a plant to grow, what we do with a plant is to remove the weeds and the rocks around it to allow it to grow. So with a stranger, that we clear away the debris that can get in the way of that person developing, and then allow that person to be, you know, who they are. And please understand that I'm not talking about only a literal stranger in the sense of someone who comes from a place and we see for the first time, but I'm talking about the strangers that are in our own midst. I mean, the strangers that may be in your families. And I think we all know what that is, to know someone who is in our circle of friends or within our family, who really is a stranger to us, and who, for whatever reason, has never felt the possibility of sharing who they are or receiving from you who you are. And I think that Nouwen goes to some length, in fact, to describe how this can happen in the relationship between teacher and student, between pastor or healer and patient or friend, and even between parent and child. And that maybe is the best illustration in terms of the personal level, to look at what it means to have this relationship of hospitality between parent and child. Because what it means is that we look at a child. I'm not a parent, and I'm looking at it from the viewpoint of someone who watches families, and I'm quick to say that. But then Henry Nouwen's not a parent either, so I don't mind if he can talk about it, so can I. Children are not properties that we own or that we rule over, but rather gifts from God to cherish and care for. And in that sense, our children are our most important guests, because they are the ones who enter our home, who need the most attention, who need very careful attention and nurture, who stay for a while, and then they leave, and they follow their own way. And if we think of our children in this way, of guests who come to stay for a time, and the time that we have with those very special guests as being a time for this kind of openness and nurture and caring and love that allows them to be who they are, I think you can get the example of what it means to welcome any guest into one's life, into one's home. Another example, of course, husband and wife. It's so possible, and I'm sure you have seen this, it's possible for husbands and wives to be strangers to each other. And that graciousness, that ability to allow a person, to give that person that safe place to be who they are with their questions and their feelings, and to be willing to share with that person who you are. You see, hospitality is not a passive thing. It's not just letting someone do their thing, you know, and being passive. But it's being willing to confront as well, to share. Maybe share, confront's a too strong a word, but I don't think so. I think when we meet someone, a stranger, when we choose to share our life with someone, if even for a fairly short time, what we are doing is confronting that person with ourselves. And that's risky, isn't it? That takes something to be willing to say, this is who I am, and I share that with you, and I want you to share yourself with me. The way I illustrate in terms of a more mundane thing, and something which you can all understand, I think, is the act of eating and cooking and eating and drinking. Holden Village is a wonderful illustration of hospitality. And you've just come from one of the hospitality occurrences, right? The coffee hour. And as people say around here often, the coffee hour is not so much that we can have a cup of coffee or something to munch on, but it gives us a setting in which to do this kind of mutual hospitality one to another. In my life, the thing that I enjoy the most in terms of with friends is to cook for friends. I love to cook. And to me, there's no better way that I can extend hospitality to friends or to strangers than to cook for them. Because cooking is something that I do. It's not passive. It's a creation of mine. And when I finish cooking the meal and sit down with my friends to share that meal, that for me is the greatest opportunity or experience for hospitality, that giving and receiving. The church. And I think this is what I've said is kind of a to get us to this point. It seems to me that one of the real problems for many people outside the church is that they do not feel welcome. And I don't mean having two people who are assigned to be greeters on a Sunday, though that may work for some churches, and I think it's probably better than having nothing. But I'm talking about people's perception of the church, first of all, as a house of hospitality, as a place that invites, that welcomes, and the church as a community of people who welcomed a stranger in their midst. and who invite that stranger to be satisfied, to have that person's hunger and thirst satisfied at the table around which the community gathers. And I want to be very, very concrete about this. Yeah, I think if you look at your own church building, first of all, and Dan's done some neat stuff with this, that one little cartoon that you did, Dan, about a person who's a stranger and what we can do to make that person for sure know they're a stranger. If you look at your own church building, first of all, does it welcome? Does it invite? Is it a place of light and space and warmth and color and life? Does it invite the handicapped person? Does it welcome the handicapped person? Or does it throw up barriers that say, I dare you to get past this? You see what I'm saying? And there are things that we can do with our spaces for worship. Even the most god-awful, dark, dank, uninviting place of worship can be made more inviting by the people who use that place. I'm fortunate. I had a building that burned down, a church, and so it gave us an opportunity to redo a whole new space of worship. And this was pre-LBW, but we determined that we were going to have a place of light. And if you can picture this, it's kind of like, now out here you don't have White Castles, do you? White Castle hamburger places. Mm-hmm. Anyway, if you can imagine this white box sitting in the middle of a area, that's our building. It's a white box, and it's got little places where light comes in. And when you approach it, you have to go up a ramp, and it's ramped so that a person in a wheelchair or a person with a walker has an easier time than with steps. But you go into this place, and the first thing you see is this big round opening in the wall with a baptismal fountain. It's always bubbling, and there's plants around it, and you can see, it's kind of a little hint that as you walk in the door, you can look at this big opening, and you see through this space, and you see just a hint of the table, the altar table. And there's all kinds of light. In fact, it's impossible for us ever to use audiovisual in the daytime because we have this huge north exposure, this clear story, which allows all kinds of light to pour. And there are plants, and the walls are very white, and we have plants around and natural wood, and the chairs are movable. And the point is that we consciously said we want to have a place that as a person enters it, they feel drawn in. That there's something to see as they come in and are welcomed by the font and then see the altar table with the worship room and then are drawn into that space. And it's impossible in our worship space for a person to hide. Can't do it. It's done on a square configuration, and the farthest point from the central focus, which is the altar table, the farthest point from that place to any place you can sit is about 50 feet. And yet we seat over 200 people. So a person can't you know, hunker back somewhere in the corner and really hide, because they can't. It's not possible. And what I'm saying is the space itself, okay, can invite. Even more importantly, of course, are the people in that space. And again, I say I don't think just having a greeter is the best thing to do. I think it's better for the community that uses that place to be conscious of what it means to invite and welcome a stranger, so that a person doesn't remain a stranger. And in terms of the worship, that again, both the presiding minister, the assisting ministers, the whole people, by their actions, demonstrate that they are receiving and welcoming those strangers into their midst. Hospitality. Robert Hovda, who's also Roman Catholic, does a wonderful thing about that, about the
the presiding minister as host at the meal, and that whole sense of hospitality. And I think, and there, in fact, the clipping I got during coffee break talked about a person who had visited 18 different churches on successive Sundays and evaluated them in terms of their, you know, how he felt about that. And his conclusion was, it says, it's a scale in which he gave points about being welcome, a smile from a worshiper, a greeting from someone sitting nearby, exchange of names, invitation to have coffee, invitation to return. He says, on this scale, 11 of the 18 churches earned fewer than 100 points. 5 actually received less than 20. The conclusion, the doctrine may be biblical, the singing inspirational, the sermon uplifting, but when a visitor finds nobody who cares whether he's there, he or she is not likely to come back. Hospitality. One final illustration from the New Testament this time, and then I'd like to hear your thoughts, and we can talk some more about of what this hospitality business might mean in your life, in the life of the church. I think you'll recognize the story. I'm only going to read a part of it. Well, I'll take the context. Remember Jesus, these two disciples on the road to Emmaus on Easter day, and they're walking along, talking about what's happened, and this stranger appears walking alongside of them. And they begin talking to the stranger, and the stranger, who is Jesus, begins to tell them about the scripture. And then this passage ends this way. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He appeared to be going further, but they constrained him, saying, "Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed, and broke it, and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished out of their sight. They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem. Again, what happens? They welcome the stranger, and the stranger becomes the host. The stranger becomes one who shares himself with them, and they are enriched. They who were the host, welcoming the stranger, become enriched by the one who becomes their host. Okay, I rattled on for long enough. Comments?
I like the way you ended that, Craig, because so many times we don't get the blessing because we don't respond to the knock on the door or the stranger. And for instance, this spring, an elderly gentleman came to my door and I was all alone in the house, and I thought, you know, I don't have to answer the door because I had no idea who it was. And then he left, and I went to the door later to get the mail, and it was the Billy Graham representative for our area, and I missed that blessing. But he was kind enough to leave his card so I could call him.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how many times I've done that in my life.
Now, I wonder how many times we miss someone who would gift us because we are afraid.
Well, I'm thinking of this in terms of cross-cultural, because that's where we're at and where we've been for quite a few years, in a cross-cultural situation. And I really realize it there that the concept of the ugly American who goes to a foreign land and lives in his American ghetto and leaves that land without ever having either been a host or a guest of the stranger, being the person that lives in that country, and how we're on the border down in Texas, and how there, if it's becoming more and more apparent every day that the Anglos are digging their trenches deeper to separate themselves more from the strangers who are pouring across the border. And how sad that is, because if they ever once practiced this concept of hospitality, they would really see how they enrich you. You don't end up giving them anything. You know, you have all these stereotypes of, you know, they're gonna take over this, take over that, they're gonna get our welfare, this, you know, you just hear all the propaganda, but it's not that way. If you one time get to know just one of them on a personal basis, you'll become very enriched by it rather than impoverished by it.
We are impoverished when we don't
receive
that.
Mm-hmm. Also, being from Tucson, where the sanctuary movement was real active, it's kind of disheartening to see what happened.
Yeah. Good example.
Our country convicted them. So is that what happened?
Well, that's a good, I'm glad you, that's an excellent thing to bring up, because that's clearly, I think, and this is my, again, a personal opinion, very much so, but I think the sanctuary movement that is growing in the churches is a very beautiful, a clear example of this hospitality, of being prepared to welcome the stranger even at risk. And I don't think that decision of that court, and I followed it pretty carefully, the judge made it basically impossible for the defense to argue on the basis of conscience or morality. And I don't think it was a victory for the government. It was in a sense, because the people, some of them were convicted, not all, but some were convicted. But I think that won't dampen the sanctuary movement at all. Do you think? I mean, if you're from the area, do you see it at dampening or?
Well, I don't know too many of the people, but I think it certainly has thrown a wrench in some of the families. You know, I mean, I can think of a couple people that I don't think feel real blessed by having done that, don't you? Well, like John Fife's wife, I mean, was totally distraught.
He was one of the ones convicted for,
But I think you're probably, that's the hopeful side of it.
The cost that those individuals are paying is a high one. And there's no way of ignoring that. I believe that the sign of their witness is what I meant, that the movement is not going to be dampened by the fact that the government has taken that action. I mean, I see more churches making that decision to become sanctuaries, not fewer.
That the risk that they took, I think, was a knowing risk, as I understand it. They understood that. And yet that witness of what it means to be a Christian community open, it's a perfect example, really, of what I've been talking about, of the hospitality to strangers.
Yeah. I guess the community as a whole seems somewhat less supportive than you would hope, but maybe that's nothing.
I think. Yeah, because our world doesn't think in those, and that's, again, the reality. I mean, I've been in homes, and there's a thing about security. I'm not poo-pooing the fact that people need to be secure. But I've been in homes in the general community, not the exact community, but the general area, where you'll see three and four locks on the door. People would never open the door to a stranger. And that's a whole issue about, who can you trust? And we obviously have to be concerned about protecting ourselves. But what have we lost in the process? And what are we losing? Hospitality. I had experience. I'll tell you a story about something that's not nearly as dramatic as what you just said, and it's not it's in a way that cross-cultural. When you think of what you were saying before, I was in China 4 years ago, and I was there for 2 weeks,
and fascinating place, and you know, talk about a different cultural experience and setting. And our group had been invited to, this tour was sponsored by the government, and our group had been invited to a formal banquet, and we kind of had this deja vu of, you thought Richard Nixon was going to walk through the door with the great banquet or the great hall. But I was, just by accident, ended up sitting next to the host of the banquet, who is the provincial head, and it's kind of like something between a governor and the president. The province is a large area in China, and I was dancing in. He was important enough not to have to speak English. The rest of the Chinese did, and he had his own interpreter. So he and I had our own private interpreter. And the first course was about maybe 8-10 different appetizer dishes. And I determined ahead of time that I was going to just be watched very carefully and try to avoid making some major faux pas that would embarrass myself, both me and the group. So I watched, and the host took this pair of very ceremonial chopsticks and served me, and then served himself, and put them down, and we both started to eat. And we were talking to the interpreter, and this went on for about maybe 10, 15 minutes. And then a second course of appetizers, the next dish round served. There's an enormous number of courses in a Chinese banquet. And so I thought for a second, and I said, I wanted to do something to let this host know, because I was his only audience, or I was only his only contact. He was talking just to me. But I wanted to do something in response to him. He was being very gracious. So I thought for a second, and I took these chopsticks. I reached over and took the thermal chopsticks, and I served him, and I served myself, and I put them down. And he looked at me, and I looked at him. And the interpreter said, in English, "Why did you do that?" I thought, oh no. This is it. And I said, "Why? What's the matter?" And he said, "That is a sign of I forget what exact English word to use, but of graciousness, that you would do that." And Mr. whatever his name was, is very moved, is very flattered. He had spoken to his interpreter in Chinese. I said, "Thank you, Lord." Instinct sometimes wins out. But it was, that's the kind of thing too, where we follow our instincts and our senses and not be afraid to reach out to someone who is a stranger, who is unfamiliar. And I was over my head. I didn't know what I was doing there. But I simply reacted in what I thought would be a way of saying thank you to this person. And it worked. It worked out. And it seems to me that in our churches, and that really, I guess, was my primary point to share with you today, is that in our churches, we simply do not do a good enough job in letting people know who come into our churches that they're welcome. And think about it. I mean, even people who are lifelong church members, you know, Lutherans or whatever they are, even for them, the first time they come is a difficult thing. What do you think it is for a person who comes for whatever reason, out of curiosity? I mean, how many people come into our churches who are truly strangers to the Christian gospel, the Christian community? How few of those people do we get? I mean, just... And I think part of the reason is people don't know and don't feel that they're welcome. And if we proclaim the gospel that we say we do proclaim, of God's gracious love, God's gracious acceptance in Christ, and we get and everything we do communicates just the opposite, is it any wonder that the world is not responding more to what we say?
It takes the traditional Lutheran only one experience to go up to somebody and say, "I don't believe I know you. Are you new here?" And to discover they've been members for 11 years.
Yeah.
But that's a dumb way to go at it. I mean, an incorrect way, better. Simply to say, I don't believe I know who you are, I'm so-and-so, and then you're covered. Mm-hmm. It's how you go at it, and you can get covered. There are lots of ways of going at it besides embarrassing yourself.
Yeah, people are afraid of being embarrassed.
Yeah, that's why they don't do it.
But that's once they're inside the building. I'm more concerned about the fact that they're never coming into the building even because of the barriers that we have set up. And of course, down on the border, it's a lot of it is a language barrier that we have set up. And so, you know, that keeps...
That's a barrier too, sure.
Somebody from coming in. So there's a lot of things that we communicate just by the type of sign that you use or the music that they hear coming out. Recently, I heard a speaker say that our hymnal is nothing more than a theological statement of our past. And that really has caused me to think about what do we communicate to by just even having hymn books in the racks that says, this is the way we do it here. And if you don't know how to do it here, you have to learn how to do it this way or else go somewhere else. Because this is... And I think that communicates too, just that rigidity in worship. Even if we're what we think is flexible, it's often very rigid. If we're talking about someone who has totally come in off the street, if they've come in from the Methodist Church or the Baptist, well, they're a little bit used to things, and they'll soon fall into the swing of it. But there's a lot of people out there who don't know the Lord, period, and have never known the Lord. And they're coming in cold, and what do we communicate with even our furnishings and our pews and our books and all these things?
Yeah, that's what I meant too, is that, and you know, there's no way that we can make any liturgy known instantly to a stranger. But what we can do is to do that liturgy or that worship in a way that a person feels included and welcomed. That it's not, we're not doing some little cultic thing that you have to really pay your dues to be able to get into, but they can just, they feel welcome. I mean, how we commune, what our communion practices are. I mean, how difficult do we make it for a person? Now I'm not talking about now a person who's a complete stranger, but I'm talking about another Christian or for goodness sakes, another Lutheran. I can remember back, you know, where you'd have to do this enormous procedure to be sure that you were a member of the right club before you were welcome at the table. And the joy that people, I mean, if everyone's face is buried in the book and we kind of mumble our way through the liturgy and the pastor's demeanor is one that suggests, you know, sternness or whatever, and there's no sense of friendliness or hospitality, that's the word we're using today, a person's not going to feel welcome. And maybe won't come back. To me, as a pastor of a congregation, it's just like you said before, I have the belief that if a person comes into the place, comes into our church, that he or she will know they're welcome. Whether they return, that's them in the spirit, but they will feel welcome, but to get people there, and how do we do that? How we communicate that? I don't know.
Well, that's where being hospitable on the street and in our homes builds those bridges wherein the person then feels comfortable about coming into our midst as family of believers. Mm-hmm. If we're not hospitable outside, we'll never be hospitable in the church.
That's right. If you haven't seen Dan's little, what was that in, Dan? That.
Oh, it was in the research packet that was in the Lutheran magazine.
Yeah, that's right. Lutheran reproduced it, right. If you haven't seen that, you should get it from the Resource Center because it's a one page, it's a cartoon of how we can make people feel unwelcome. Isn't that was basically what you did?
It's negative.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was negative, that's true.
But Craig, I'm thinking of my neighborhood too, how it starts there, the hospitality, and trying to reach out and bring, you know, just your own neighborhood. I live in Mormon country, and my Mormon neighbors have food for me in case I'm going to need it someday. They have a warehouse in their basement, and they're going to feed me. and they're very much concerned about me if I need help. But my other neighbors aren't, and I, as a Christian, need to reach out to the neighbors too and have the hospitality start right next door and then bring those people into church. Mm-hmm. And I'm really not concerned whether it's the church I attend, but just church, you know, Christian church. And I find that I've been in my neighborhood now 6 years, and it's taken me this long to have dialogue with some of the neighbors, and there's still two that I haven't had. And it's a concern I have just in my own territory.
I think one of the things that draws people to Holden is the expectation or the sense of Holden as community. I think that I don't regard Holden as being a perfect community. It's not. I think that there are people who work at creating community here, and there are other people who kind of pass through, you know, remaining pretty much strangers. And that may be a good illustration, you know, of how it does work.
We choose, we make choices.
There's a quote from Martin Buber, which I think is a good one. He says, community is being no longer side by side, but with one another or a multitude of persons, which made me think of Holden. And this multitude, though it moves towards one goal, yet experiences everywhere a turning to, a dynamic facing of the others, a flowing of I to thou. Community is where community happens. Community is where community happens, which means that we either are creating community in our hospitality, or we are remaining strangers to each other.
I live in India. Fortunate enough to live in a three-generation household, and have for some time, and it's not a large home, so we're with each other a lot, and thinking of hospitality in the home, I don't think you have acceptance, that you always accept each other, you know, as you are, if you're sad or happy or mad or whatever, that you forget about it.
Mm-hmm. Allow that person, if they want to be a pain in the behind.
Or if I want to be.
Or if you want to be.
Or if I am.
Yeah.
To somebody else. Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't think I am, but to that person I am at that time. Mm-hmm. And yet we're hospitable to each other. Mm-hmm. We don't reject each other. So I think of it more as acceptance.
We should make this group an infectious underground movement in Holden, and we'll just go out into Holden and infect the place with hospitality.
Well, I think she brings up an important point, though, when she says the three generation, too, because, again, in Arizona, I mean, we have the retirement communities, you know, and they vote against the schools, and then we have all these distinct groups, and that's true in the church, too. The older people don't. Well, the older people, in many cases, are more accepting than the middle-aged people.
Oh, I think so.
Of which I'm one of them. You know, new things. And the middle-aged people are often real intolerant of teenagers, maybe because they have them themselves, I don't know. We have all these groups. We don't appreciate what each of us has to bring. And I don't know if there's anything you can do about that. But I wish there was.
Be a subversive. I really think that's the secret. You know, you gotta just, like, if you're in one group, then just kind of subvert yourself into another group and say, here I am.
Yeah.
You know, deal with me now. I want to deal with you.
Uh-huh.
We get too comfortable in our own little, whatever it is, however we identify ourselves. You know, I'm a clergy and you're not, so there. Or I'm male and you're female. Or I'm white and you're black. Or I'm younger and you're older. Or whatever it is. And then we stay strangers.
Well, when you refer to, you know, that we have to give, like, plant that you clear away so that it can grow, you clear away the weeds, etc., so the plant can grow, and we're supposed to do that for our children. And yet, again, you know, I have to keep thinking cross-culturally. We haven't wanted to allow that to the Indians, the blacks, and now the Hispanics. We want them to become like us, and then they're okay. But if they want to be their own culture, then we stifle that. We just keep putting it down.
Don't you think the church is changing in that regard, though, that there is a growing, there's more of an understanding and acceptance of that different cultural experience than there was, say, 25 years ago or 20 years ago?
Oh, I'm sure that it's changing, but it's so slow, and it's so slow in comparison to, you know, I have to think Hispanic, and it's so slow in comparison to the numbers of Hispanics that are pouring into America that we are not reaching. And once they're here a certain amount of time, I think the ability to reach them will be lost, because the time of transition is the time that they're the most open to the gospel.
Pastor was here last week from Texas, and he was saying that the Hispanic churches, the Hispanic Lutherans in Texas, were saying to Lutheran Church now, you know, if you're serious about wanting to be inclusive, then make decisions in regards to opening churches and starting new ministries. That means money, means resources and commitment, not just saying that we'd like to be inclusive. You mentioned the worship book. It's interesting because, in a sense, the Lutheran Book of Worship was a step in that direction, simply by the hymnody breaking open from a Germanic Scandinavian, almost totally or completely that, into hymns like we sang last night. Lift Every Voice and Sing is what a gift to us Lutherans that we can sing that hymn and have that in our book. But you're right, of course, there's still a lot to do. I think that some of the stuff that's going to happen this week, we'll be looking very close, looking at the Hispanic experience and talking about that in terms of the life of the church. And again, it's not, see, the old way of looking at it is we're going to do this for them, never thinking about what they're going to do for us, which may be more than we're doing for them. And that's why I use those stories about that in both the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, New Testament, is that God, when God's people become are gracious and hospitable, they receive back more than they give. That's fascinating to me. I mean, it's clearly there. I could do a whole thing on Abraham and Sarah, though. That laughing Sarah, I mean, that's just one of my favorite stories about. You see Sarah kind of doubled up behind the tent going,
yeah.
Anybody else? Yes.
I'm interested in this matter of the LBW. I think we have a problem or a balance to maintain, and that's the balance of worshiping in our own tradition and also being open to some variation which is more appealing to people of a different background. You know, you could take the one stance which says, as you did, or somebody over here, that they take us as we are. They'll get to learn this liturgy or we leave them out. They just have to get to where we are. I think that's a little strong on that direction. And then the other is the freedom we sometimes take to alter the liturgy to fit our particular needs. So some of us do that, some of us don't do that. It all depends on who we are. And I admit to wishing that we had a little bit of flexibility in some of our services to appeal to people who are not like we are. I sometimes think the rigidity of our worship and the form of our worship, and I'm a heretic on this, is a block to evangelism. That's a strong stance. And I think those people will learn our liturgy if they come back. But I'm not sure all of them are coming back, because if you want to look at it that way, not a lack of hospitality, their inability to handle. And so just a thought, and I have to balance it because I lean. I'm not a high liturgist, and therefore I lean the other way. We had a pastor in Alaska, ALC pastor, who has written dozens, literally dozens of orders of worship for his Eskimo people. And it was just interesting, all the variety that you can have. So once in a while, I could wish we would be a little less modern. That's all. Mm-hmm. But that's a matter of balance.
I'm familiar with in my synod, we have a Native American congregation in Wisconsin. And there too, the community uses Lutheran Book of Worship and also has developed liturgies and prayers and so forth that express the Native American experience.
And I'm not saying that you can't be friendly with a former order of worship, because you sure can.
Mm-hmm. Informal worship can be very sloppy and very uninviting. I mean, right?
I mean,
I appreciate your being here, and I hope that you will, as I said, be subversive, hospital people in the community, and carry it back with you, and just look around, as you return to your own communities and your own churches and your own home, as I plan to, just look and see what you see. Look at that place through the eyes of a stranger and ask yourself, would I feel welcome here?